TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. 9/11, the myth and the reality. An overflow audience welcomed David Ray Griffin, the theologian who challenges the Bush administration's official story about the events of 9/11. Carol Bruyer is a co-founder of Making Contact, a weekly radio program. She led marches to demand a congressional investigation of 9/11. She introduced David Ray Griffin at the Grand Lake Theater.
It's an honor and pleasure to introduce our main speaker, author of The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, a Critique of the Keene-Sellico Report. When people face a problem, they usually ask, "What can I do?" However, when confronted with 9/11 truths that shatter their worldviews, people must ask themselves, "Who am I?" Dr. David Ray Griffin has spent much of his life examining questions about who we are and our relationship with the universe. A professor of philosophy of religion and theology emeritus at Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University, co-director of the Center for Process Studies. He has authored 15 books, edited a dozen more, and has authored over 100 articles and chapters, presented innumerable papers and lectures. He's renowned for his theological work and a recipient of the Book Prize of the Scientific and Medical Network. In Process Theology, an introductory exposition, he and his co-author, John B. Cobb Jr., present a way of understanding God's existence and our own as a co-creative process where humans individually and collectively have the freedom, responsibility, and opportunity to imagine and realize a better or worse future for all. Dr. Griffin has overcome the central political and spiritual challenge confronting humanity at this eternally critical moment: fear. In 1976, he and Cobb wrote, "The choice of life, which is the choice of God's call, is the highest freedom in itself. Hope grows with the ability to respond. Despair grows with the self-chosen closing in of horizons. To be responsible is not finally to shoulder an unendurable burden. It is to share in the divine adventure in the world, although its outcome is never assured. In itself, it is joyful. The one who experiences the joy of this participation in the divine life hopes urgently for success, but accepts the risk that the only reward may be in the joy itself. By deconstructing the foundational lies of the war on terrorism, courageously dispelling fear to champion truth and light the path towards a hopeful future, Dr. Griffin is an inspiration to all who reject fear, terror, war, and lies, and to all who cherish life, health, peace, and truth. The fact that he can enjoy challenging the most threatening empire the world has ever seen makes it possible and compelling for all of us to join him in this journey. Please welcome Dr. David Ray Griffin.
Good evening. In this lecture, I'm going to try to give you your money's worth. That's code for this is going to be a very long lecture. Although I have given many lectures about 9/11, I had, prior to this one, never devoted an entire lecture to simply summarizing what I take to be the strongest evidence against the official account of 9/11. I will do this in terms of the distinction between myth and reality. The official story about 9/11, according to which America, because of its goodness, was attacked by fanatical Arab Muslims who hate our freedoms, has clearly functioned as a sacred myth for the United States since that fateful day. And this function appears to have been carefully orchestrated. The very next day, President Bush announced his intention to lead a monumental struggle of good versus evil. Then on September 13th, he declared that the following day would be a national day of prayer and remembrance for the victims of the terrorist attacks. And on that next day, the president himself, surrounded by Billy Graham, a cardinal, a rabbi, and an imam, delivered a sermon in the National Cathedral saying, "Our responsibility to history is already clear, to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil. War has been waged against us by stealth and deceit and murder. This nation is peaceful, but fierce when steered to anger. In every generation, the world has produced enemies of human freedom. They have attacked America because we are freedom's home and defender. And the commitment of our fathers is now the calling of our time. We ask Almighty God to watch over our nation and grant us patience and resolve in all that is to come. And may He always guide our country. God bless America." Through this unprecedented event, in which the President of the United States issued a declaration of war from a cathedral, French author Thierry Masson observed in 2002, "The American government consecrated its version of the events. From then on, any questioning of the official truth would be seen as sacrilege." That attitude has remained dominant in the public sphere until this day, as the official account has continued to serve as a sacred myth. When people raise questions about this story, they are either ignored, ridiculed as conspiracy theorists, or, as Charlie Sheen has recently experienced, personally attacked. When someone asks what right the administration has to invade and occupy other countries, to imprison people indefinitely without due process, or even to ignore various laws, the answer is always the same: 9/11. Those who believe that U.S. law and international law should be respected are dismissed as having a pre-9/11 mindset. Given the role the official account of 9/11 has played and continues to play, the most important question before our country today is whether this account, besides being a myth in the religious sense, is also a myth in the pejorative sense, that is, whether it is simply false. Using the word myth from now on only in this pejorative sense, I will discuss 9 of the major myths contained in the official story about 9/11. I will thereby show that the official account of 9/11 cannot be defended in light of the relevant evidence against the main alternative, according to which 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by people within our own government. I will begin with a few myths that prevent many people from even looking at the evidence for this alternative account. Myth number 1. Our political and military leaders simply would not do such a thing. This idea is widely believed, but it is undermined by much evidence. The United States, like many other countries, has often used deceit to begin wars. For example, the American-Mexican War, with its false claim that Mexico had shed American blood on American soil. The Spanish-American War, with its Remember the Maine incidents. The war in the Philippines, with its false claim that the Filipinos fired the first shot. And the Vietnam War, with its Gulf of Tonkin hoax. The U.S. government has also sometimes organized false flag terrorist attacks, killing innocent civilians, then blaming the attacks on an enemy country or group, often by planting evidence. As Daniel Ganser has shown in his recent book, NATO's Secret Armies, NATO, guided by the CIA and the Pentagon, arranged many such attacks in Western European countries during the Cold War, in which hundreds of people were killed by bombs or hooded men with shotguns. These attacks were successfully blamed on communists and other leftists to discredit them in the eyes of the voting public. Finally, if it be thought that the U.S. military would not orchestrate such attacks against American citizens, one needs only to read the plans known as Operation Northwoods, which the Joint Chiefs of Staff worked up in 1962, shortly after Fidel Castro had overthrown the pro-American dictator Batista. This plan contained various pretexts which would provide justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba. Some of them would have involved killing Americans. For example, I remember the Maine incident. We could blow up a ship, a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay, and blame Cuba. At this point, some people, having seen evidence that U.S. leaders would be morally capable of orchestrating 9/11, might avoid looking at the evidence by appeal to myth number 2. Our political and military leaders would have had no motive for orchestrating the 9/11 attacks. This myth, which is widely held, was reinforced by the 9/11 Commission report. While explaining that Al-Qaeda had ample motives for carrying out the attack, this report mentions no motives that U.S. leaders might have had. But the alleged motive of Al-Qaeda, that it hated America and its freedoms, is dwarfed by a motive held by many members of the Bush-Cheney administration, the dream of establishing a global Pax Americana, the first all-inclusive empire in history. This dream had been articulated by many neoconservatives, or neocons, throughout the 1990s, after the disintegration of the Soviet Union made it seem possible. It was first officially articulated in the Defense Planning Guidance of 1992, drafted by Paul Wolfowitz on behalf of then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, a document that has been called a blueprint for permanent American global hegemony and Cheney's plan to rule the world. Achieving this goal would require four things. One of these was getting control of the world's oil, especially in Central Asia and the Middle East. And the Bush-Cheney administration came to power with plans already made to attack Afghanistan and Iraq. A second requirement was a technological transformation of the military, in which fighting from space would become central. A third requirement was an enormous increase in military spending to pay for these new wars and this weaponization of space. A fourth need was to modify the doctrine of preemptive attack so that America would be able to attack other countries even if they presented no imminent threat. These four elements, moreover, would require a fifth, an event that would make the American people ready to accept these imperialistic policies. As Zbigniew Brzezinski explained in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, the American people, with their democratic instincts, are reluctant to authorize the money and human sacrifices necessary for imperial mobilization. And this refusal limits America's capacity for military intimidation. But this impediment could be overcome if there were a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat, just as the American people were willing to enter World War II after the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The same idea was suggested in 2000 in a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was put out by a neocon think tank called the Project for the New American Century, many members of which, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz, became central members of the Bush administration. This document, referring to the goal of transforming the military, said that this process of transformation is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. When the attacks of 9/11 occurred, they were treated like a new Pearl Harbor. Several members of the administration spoke of opportunities provided by the 9/11 attacks. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said that 9/11 created the kind of opportunities that World War II offered to refashion the world. It created, in particular, the opportunity to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, to increase the military budget enormously, to go forward with military transformation, and to turn the new idea of preemptive warfare into official doctrine. This doctrinal change was announced in the 2002 version of the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, which said that America will act against emerging threats before they are fully formed. So not only did the Bush administration reap huge benefits from 9/11, these were benefits that it had desired in advance. The idea that it would have had no motives for orchestrating 9/11 is a myth. But there is one more myth that keeps many people from looking at the evidence. This is myth number three. Such a big operation involving so many people could not have been kept a secret because someone involved in it would have talked by now. This claim is based on a more general myth, which is that it is impossible for secret government operations to be kept secret very long because someone always talks. But how could one know this? If some big operations have remained secret until now, we, by definition, don't know about them. Moreover, we do know about some big operations that were kept secret as long as necessary. such as the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb, and the war in Indonesia in 1957, which the United States provoked, participated in, and then kept secret until 1995. Many more examples could be given. We can understand, moreover, why those with inside knowledge of 9/11 would not talk. At least most of them would have been people with the proven ability to keep secrets. Those who were directly complicit would also be highly motivated to avoid public disgrace and the gas chamber. Those people who had knowledge without being complicit could be induced to keep quiet by means of more or less subtle threats, such as, "Joe, if you go forward with your plan to talk to the press, I don't know who is going to protect your wife and kids from some nutcase angered by your statement." I come now to myth number 4. The 9/11 Commission, which has endorsed the official account, was an independent, impartial commission, and hence can be believed. One needs only to look at the reviews of the 9/11 Commission report on Amazon.com to see that this assumption is widely accepted. The Commission's lack of impartiality can be partly explained by the fact that Chairman Thomas Kane, most of the other commissioners, and at least half of the members of the staff had conflicts of interest. The most serious problem, however, is that the executive director, Philip Zelikow, was essentially a member of the Bush-Cheney administration. He had worked with Condoleezza Rice on the National Security Council in the administration of the first President Bush. Then, when the Republicans were out of office, he and Condoleezza Rice wrote a book together. Then, when she was appointed National Security Advisor for the next Bush administration, she brought on Zelikow to help with the transition with the new National Security Council. Finally, he was appointed to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Zelikow was, therefore, the White House's man inside the 9/11 Commission. And yet, as executive director, he guided the staff, which did virtually all the work of the commission. Zelikow was in position, therefore, to decide which topics would be investigated and which topics not. One disgruntled staff member reportedly said at the time, "Zelikow is calling the shots. He's skewing the investigation and running it his own way." Accordingly, the commission was not independent from the executive branch. Insofar as the commission was supposed to be investigating the failure of the Bush administration to prevent the attacks, the commission was no more independent and impartial than if Dick Cheney had been running it. This fact is further shown by one more fact about Zelikow that until now has not been widely known, I believe, even within the 9/11 truth movement. I mentioned earlier the Bush administration's national security strategy statement of 2002, in which the new doctrine of preemptive warfare was articulated. The primary author of this document, reports James Mann in Rise of the Vulcans, was none other than Philip Zelikow. According to Mann, after Rice saw a first draft, which had been written by Richard Haass in the State Department, she, wanting something bolder, brought in Zelikow to completely rewrite it. The result was a document that used 9/11 to justify a very bellicose foreign policy. Max Boot called it essentially a neocon document. We can understand, therefore, why the commission, under Zelikow's leadership, would have ignored all evidence that would point to the truth, that 9/11 was a false flag operation intended to authorize the doctrines and funds needed for a new level of imperial mobilization. Talk about the fox leading the investigation into the raid on the hen house. The suggestion that 9/11 was a false flag operation brings us to myth number 5. The Bush administration provided proof that the attacks were carried out by al-Qaeda terrorists under the direction of Osama bin Laden. One of the main pieces of alleged proof involved the claim that the baggage of Muhammad Atta, called the ringleader of the hijackers, was discovered at the Boston airport from which Flight 11 departed. This baggage, besides containing Otto's passport and driver's license, also contained various types of incriminating evidence, a flight computer, flight simulator manuals, videotapes about Boeing airliners, a copy of the Quran, and a letter to other hijackers about preparing for the mission. But the bags also contained Atta's will. Why would Atta have intended to take his will on a plane that he planned to fly into the World Trade Center? There are also many other problems with this story. We seem to have planted evidence. One final little problem is that several of these 19 men, according to stories published on the BBC and in British newspapers, are still alive. For example, the 9/11 Commission report named Waleed al-Shiri as one of the hijackers and reproduced the FBI's photograph of him. It even suggested that al-Shiri was the one who stabbed one of the flight attendants shortly before Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower. But as BBC News had reported 10 days after 9/11, al-Shiri, having seen his photograph in newspapers and TV programs, notified authorities and journalists in Morocco, where he works as a pilot, that he is still alive. But if there are various problems with the government's story about the hijackers, surely it presented proof that Osama bin Laden was behind the operation. Insofar as this belief is widely held, it is also a myth. Secretary of State Colin Powell promised to provide a white paper providing proof that the attacks had been planned by Osama, but this paper was never produced. British Prime Minister Tony Blair did produce such a paper, but it begins with the admission that it does not purport to provide a prosecutable case against Osama bin Laden in a court of law. So, evidence good enough to go to war, but not to go to court. And although the Taliban said that it would hand bin Laden over if the United States presented evidence of his involvement in 9/11, Bush refused. This failure to provide proof was later said to be unnecessary because bin Laden, in a video allegedly found in Afghanistan, admitted responsibility for the attacks. This video is now widely cited as proof. But the man in this video has darker skin, fuller cheeks, and a broader nose than the Osama bin Laden of all the other videos. We again seem to have planted evidence. There are, moreover, other problems in the official account of Osama bin Laden. For one thing, in June of 2001, when he was already America's most wanted criminal, he reportedly spent 2 weeks in the American hospital in Dubai, was treated by an American doctor, and visited by the local CIA agent. Also, after 9/11, when America was reportedly trying to get Osama dead or alive, the U.S. military evidently allowed him to escape on at least 4 occasions, the last one being the Battle of Tora Bora, which the London Telegraph labeled a grand charade. Shortly thereafter, Bush said, "I don't know where bin Laden is. I really don't care. It's not our priority." Sometimes the truth slips out. In any case, the idea that the Bush administration has provided proof for its claims about Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda hijackers is a myth. I turn now to myth number 6. The 9/11 attacks came as a surprise to the Bush administration. Nothing is more essential to the official story than this idea. About 10 months after 9/11, FBI Director Robert Mueller said, "To this day, we have found no one in the United States except the actual hijackers who knew of the plot." There is much evidence, however, that counts against this claim. One type of evidence involves an extraordinarily high volume of put options purchased in the 3 days prior to 9/11. To buy put options for a particular company is to bet that its stock price will go down. These extraordinary purchases included 2 and only 2 airlines, United and American, the 2 airlines used in the attacks. They also included Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which occupied 22 stories of the World Trade Center. The price of these shares did, of course, plummet after 9/11, resulting in enormous profits for the purchasers. These unusual purchases, as the San Francisco Chronicle said, raised suspicions that the investors had advanced knowledge of the strikes. The 9/11 Commission tried to show these suspicions to be unfounded. It claimed, for example, that the purchases for United Airlines do not show anyone other than al-Qaeda had foreknowledge because 95% of these options were purchased by a single U.S.-based institutional investor with no conceivable ties to al-Qaeda. But the Commission thereby simply begged the question at issue, which is whether some organization other than Al-Qaeda was involved in the planning. I'm not making this up. Further evidence of advanced knowledge is shown by the behavior of President Bush and his Secret Service agents at the photo op at the school in Florida that morning. According to the official story, when Bush was first told that a plane had struck one of the Twin Towers, he dismissed the incident as a horrible accident. News of the second strike, however, would have indicated, assuming that the strikes were unexpected, that terrorists were using planes to attack high-value targets. And what could have been a higher-value target than the President of the United States? His location at the school had been highly publicized. It is standard procedure for the Secret Service to rush the President to a safe location whenever there is any sign of danger. And yet these agents allowed the President to remain another half hour at the school, even permitting him to deliver an address on TV, thereby announcing to the world that he was still at the school. Would not this behavior be explainable only if the head of the Secret Service detail knew that the planned attacks did not include an attack on the President? The 9/11 Commission, of course, did not ask this question. It was content to report that the Secret Service told us they did not think it imperative for the President to run out the door. Can anyone seriously believe that the highly trained Secret Service would act this way in a situation of genuine danger?
That was part one of a two-part program on 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, by David Ray Griffin. Come back for part two, where David Ray Griffin describes a scene in the emergency operations bunker under the White House. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta testified that Dick Cheney was aware of an aircraft approaching the Pentagon, but did nothing. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org for more information. That's TUCRadio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.